Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Pro Lacrosse podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt, the gear and lifestyle editor for Inside Lacrosse. And today I am joined, as always, by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside Lacrosse freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
Yes, and what a wild weekend of professional lacrosse action. We have recaps of every game from both leagues, Major League Lacrosse and Premier Lacrosse League. Chris, you're going first. It's your MLL week, and I am sorry that it looks like you had to watch four games in a row. It's tough. It's a tough break, but let's start with Denver and Dallas. Tell me about that game.
Okay, so that was Thursday night. Denver, let's go ahead and just get the score out of the way right now. Denver 15, Dallas 9.
Ooh.
Good things for the Dallas Rattlers. Luke Wittenberg is back in the lineup, and probably, I'm just going to say, top of my head, probably their most dynamic midfield presence on a solid basis. They're getting some sparks from a couple guys. We can get into that because they played twice this week, so we can get into that later. But like I said, Luke Wittenberg's back, and he helped the Rattlers come out very strong. They looked solid at the gate. At one point, they led 7-6. So you know, put a pin in that. So that's the good Rattler stuff. Also coming out strong, John Grant Jr. I would say, so on Thursday when I was taking notes during this game, I said this was his best game since he returned. He really just did the damage in the first half, and when the game got really out of hand, he kind of set out, but that's kind of double understandable. First of all, him being a coach still, you know, if he can use some teaching opportunities from the sideline, then yeah, go ahead. And also, not being the youngest cat out there, you know, no point in running him around. Actually, one more reason, they had another game a couple days later, so yeah, rest him when they could. Made total sense. But anyway, like I said, Rattlers were actually leading 7-6. Then the Outlaws came back and scored 6 in a row, and Dallas never really caught up after that. Zach Currier, career high 6 points, which is surprising. Obviously, 6 points is a good amount, but I feel like if you told me his high was like 8,
yeah,
reasonable, right?
Didn't we have a discussion about this? I think it was Rambo last year, where it was like career high of like 5 points, and we were like, wait, what? That's his career high? That's weird.
Right. Like, that's a good number. It's, you know, 6 points is a great number, but, you know, I mean, just watching him play, you figure, oh, he had a game with, like, you know, 3 goals and 5 assists or something like that. Dylan Ward, excellent in goal. He's been doing consistently this season, allowed just 2 goals in the final 3 quarters, and that's largely it for that one. But I guess speaking of goal, Christian Carson Bannister didn't start for Dallas in this one. Sean Scannone from UMass got the start. Not really sure if that was just a trying him out, lineup juggling availability issue, you know, like to get kept in the dark about stuff like that. But Scannone got the start in this one and played all 4 quarters. You know, made some solid saves. This definitely wasn't his fault that they lost. I think what it comes down to, Denver is a team in somewhat finished form, and Dallas just isn't, really, you know? And also, they did lose Zach Greer in the second quarter off of a Finn Sullivan hit. Greer was kind of looking for a loose ball, turned his head, and just kind of got popped. He's kind of grabbing his back. I don't know what it was exactly, but he was gone by halftime and did not return. So, yeah, 15-9. That's how you get that.
That's bad.
It's not great.
It's real bad. I know that we're like trying not to harp on Dallas here, but like, again, this is the team that made it to the championship game last year, and now they can't even hit 10 goals. It's bad. It's real bad. What's the next game?
Next game we got Denver again.
No.
Denver flies across the country, takes on the Boston Cannons in Quincy. Denver wins 17-16. I'm going to say this was, at least MLL-wise, the best game of the weekend. Because it was, you know, kind of captivating the whole time. They had lead changes. there's a little bit of chippiness, a little shoving and stuff like that. Nothing stupid. Nobody's going to, you know, we're not going to waste a week with think pieces about it. Just a little pushing or whatever. Controversial goal slash no goal at the end that could have put things away a little bit more for Denver. And anyway, yeah, heart-stopping sort of game. So nobody led by more than three goals until the fourth quarter. And that's when Denver kind of started pulling away, you know, you thought. But then Kyle Jackson kind of put the cannons on his back for a minute and scored three of the last five goals. It's kind of tough to describe Kyle Jackson's game. It's like he does a lot of stuff that you just feel like it wouldn't work if you did it.
Yep. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
He's got the style. He's got the box style like Joe Walters, where it's just like, okay, I'm going to go with this hand and I'm going to dodge by just moving my stick and going around you. And then I'm going to bring it back to the hand. But it just, it works a lot, and it worked. This game's no exception. So yeah, Kyle Jackson cleaned up like that. This was another game where John Grant Jr. played very well. So this might actually be his best game. Maybe it wasn't the first one, because this was more of a four quarters effort. And this one was the first game he was scoring goals. And this one he was doing it, I think he had one goal, four assists. So this one was more passing. A lot of extra passes he was doing, you know, like somebody comes down on a break, feeds him, and then, you know, half a second later, he's redirecting it across crease or something like that. Like, that's not going away. You know what I mean? If he can stand there and be this kind of hinge, you know, redirecting these passes into open spaces like he was doing, you know, I don't see that setting anytime soon. Also, a couple times I think he ran into trouble footwork-wise, you know, especially after having just played. I'm sure he's probably feeling pretty good at the last game. Coming into this one, it's like, okay, let me lower the shoulder, go for a couple more roll dodge kind of things like that. You know, I still think he's figuring out what's there and what isn't there, what he can kind of, you know, pull back on command and whatnot. But I will say he was on the field pretty much the whole game. You know, we were talking earlier in the season about, like, you know, oh, is he going to do these, you know, 5 minutes at a time? Is he going to play or not? He was pretty much there the whole time. And that kind of meant that Brendan Kavanaugh was getting short stick matchups.
Yeah.
Which worked out fantastic for him. Three goals and two assists for him. The whole sort of Denver attack was very solid. Chris Aslian, three goals and an assist. Ren Lee with four goals. Yeah, solid work. Cannons-wise, so they went toe-to-toe. They fought back. You know, like I said, it was close the whole way. You know, Mark Cockerton was as insane as he always is. He had four goals, which is pretty normal for him, I'd say, right around now. But so my question here, so I'm looking at the Cannons record. It's still good. You know, one little setback here. They've got three wins under their belt, but the three wins are against the Lizards twice and the Rattlers once. Do you think they need kind of like a quality win before you can put or keep them in an upper echelon as far as these rankings go?
Yeah, I think this was their first major, major test. And I actually thought that they were going to win this one. After I watched kind of pieces of it and then couldn't watch the end of it. I had to go do something, but I expected them to like actually win because they were looking pretty hot there kind of in the beginning of the second half. I thought that this could kind of be their breakout, but I was always kind of a little suspicious because a lot of their offense leans on Sands and Zed Williams creating out of the box. And then if that neither one of those things work, they just go to Kyle Jackson and ISO and hope that Cockerton finds a way to get open to finish it if he gets tripled or doubled. And that works more than you think. And they also are great in transition, so they get a lot of great transition goals. But I think the problem is they're still hemorrhaging goals on the other side of the ball. And that defense is not – Morocco makes that defense look really good. Really good. I mean, they've had individual pulls with good games, but you can't sit here and tell me that Cannon's defense has had a great game. Like, every single player on the Cannon's defense has played well. You can't. I think the best defender one-on-one is probably Goodrich.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Which says more about him, I think, than the rest of the polls, but also says a little something about the rest of those polls. You know, I think Fahey is their one.
Yeah, I think so.
Right? I mean, he's not bad. He has trouble with Cougar guys. Just flat out. Like, he's just a guy that he's very athletic, but he is not great at keeping up with, like, little water bug style attackmen. And I think everyone knows that. So that's who they put against him. But I think that, you know, Rylan Reese has come a long way. I think he's had, like, up and down games, but I do think that he's improving a lot as a rookie. I mean, it's his first year, he's adapting. But I just, you know, you need to see a little bit more out of that Cannons kind of second midfield transition unit and the deep defense to kind of anoint them in the top three at this point after this game, right?
I'd say so. And I think that kind of transitions nicely into the next game, talking about that upper tier, because we had ourselves an upper tier sort of matchup in this one coming up. Atlanta Blaze versus the Chesapeake Bayhawks. Final score, Atlanta 19, Chesapeake 10.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, so here's the thing. You know, our producer Dan is going to do a lot of hard work here. So I am going to edit this for him because my notes say something different than yes. what I'm about to say. But I don't want him to have to go find the spot and bleep. I want to save my bleep for something else later in the season. I don't know what yet, but
yeah. You get one.
Something's going to happen.
You get one.
Make me real mad, and I want to save my bleep. So I will just say, woo-wee. Bayhawks got that butt whooped.
Yes.
It was ugly. Now, it wasn't entirely like their fault, I should say. I mean, you know, there is such a thing as bad luck, right? And Atlanta is a fantastic team, but Chesapeake didn't really get any breaks either. Kenny Massa, their face-off guy, took a headshot real early after the second faceoff. You know, he won it, came down, dished it off. There was a defenseman sliding up, kind of caught him up high, and that was it. That was his entire day. So you got the Bayhawks trying to put it together, going against number one draft pick Alex Woodall, right? So, I mean, we've seen CJ Constable do it for years and years and years and years, but he's not the number one faceoff guy you want. You know, obviously you have people specifically there to job, and he is there more for like defensive assistance if need be. So that's kind of what started this whole wheels falling off of this thing. Bayhawks actually led 4-3 after the first quarter, but then the Blaze kind of put the foot on the gas and blew them away. Second quarter, they outscored Chesapeake 7-1, and I mean, it was pretty much over by halftime. Huge, huge thing that could have been controlled as far as the Bayhawks go, at least to some degree, the ground ball fight. Second quarter, Blaze outscooped him 15-6. And that just kind of kept going like that. End of the game, the Blaze had scooped 51 ground balls to Chesapeake's 31. And a lot of them are on, like, you know, say Randy Stotts comes down and takes a shot. And, you know, Nico Motto makes the stop, but then he gives up the rebound. The Blaze were scooping those rebounds and just restarting again. And, you know, you just can't keep putting Chesapeake defense through that over and over again with that kind of attack that Atlanta's trotting out there. Basically, after that, Chesapeake, I'd say by coming out of the half, Chesapeake's basically on tilt at that point. They're just chucking up two-pointers just nonstop, just trying to close it. But, you know, they're not, like, screened two-pointers or anything. Everybody knows after, like, your third that you're just going to keep chucking up two-pointers. So it's basically open lanes, and Chris Madelon was playing great. So that was not the answer for that sort of thing. Also, they were just kind of unlucky. Hit a bunch of pipes. It was just bad. Score went from 4-4 to 15-5. You know, the dust cleared and the whole thing was just a disaster. I don't think Chesapeake's going to want to, you know, watch much of the tape from this one. I think that's kind of one of those things you say, okay, that's a whooping we got to take, and then you move on. I do want to ask you, though, Atlanta's attack, can you say that they're the best in the league, or are they competing with others for that title?
Who would they be competing with, though?
So it's tough to say it based on actual evidence because they just played them. But I mean, I would think off the top of my head, you would think maybe it would be Chesapeake. But obviously, this game in which they scored 10 goals is not very helpful in the evidence category for that sort of thing.
No. No. I would say as three guys in Shane Jackson, Randy Stats, and Tommy Palasek, that's they're playing the best right now. I don't think you can dispute that. I think that's a fair statement. Will that be the same statement at the end of the year?
Right.
I don't know. I don't know.
That's a very fair statement, though. Nobody is putting together offensive performances like these three are. And I will just say, if you haven't been paying attention to the Atlanta Blaze attack, you should probably check them out because they are doing ridiculous stuff every game.
Oh, yeah. They're just creating highlights. Like, with each other, though. It's almost like, hey, midfielders, just, like, get out of the way. Go stand up there by the two-point line. Maybe you'll get it.
Right.
Maybe. Maybe if you cut, you'll get it. But they do a lot of their own work, which I don't think you can say about a lot of attack lines in the MLL.
Right. And they're fun. I mean, they look like they're having fun, and they are fun to watch. So, yeah, definitely check them out. So, yeah, final sort of evaluation, I think it was a little bit of a fluke, but that's not to say that Atlanta would have ordinarily lost. I'm just thinking, like, a lot of bad stuff happened to the Bayhawks. So it's kind of half dominance, half bad stuff. I wouldn't necessarily say it was Chesapeake getting exposed, but I think they do have some things they'll need to tighten up on. But, I mean, really, like I said, just a lot of bad stuff happened, too.
Yeah, I think with Chesapeake, they still have, you know, 60-second shot clock. They're one of the teams that wants to use all 60 seconds. Except they have Lyle. So, and Lyle doesn't want to do that. I think you need to get a couple more people like Lyle on that offense. And just kind of let that ride. Because he's your best player. You got to build around your best player. Especially at this point. I think that's key for every team in the MLL. Like, you have no choice now. You must build around your best player. Guess what happens when you don't build around your best player?
What's that?
You're the New York Lizards. That's what happens.
Now that is another fantastic transition into our final game. New York Lizards 13, Dallas Rattlers 9.
Oh, they won!
Somebody had to
win.
Absolutely.
Ugh.
0-4 New York hosted 0-4 Dallas. And so, yeah, New York won that one. Rattlers held to single digits for the second straight game, and they have never scored more than 11 this season.
You missed your first line, which is gold, and you have to say it now.
Oh, yes, yes. Least anticipated game of the Pro Lacrosse weekend by far. I mean, just... your record is what you are, right?
You are what you are, man.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell to get people out for 0-4 versus 0-4. But yeah, I will say this, though. Just like the previous loss, the Rattlers came out very strong. And this was a Rattlers team that was like a kind of handicapped, kind of hamstrung from the last game. They lost, I mentioned Greer, but they also lost two other players in that game. That was a brutal game for them. But they still were very strong in this one. Jake Sahow, probably his best game. He's got range on his shot. Okay, I'm only using this comparison because they're both human beings who shoot on the run. And that is where it stops.
Got it.
But he scored a shot with his foot, like, maybe over the line. That was like how Romar Dennis would shoot last season, where you split and then you fire it, like, earlier than you would anticipate a human should try to fire a shot.
Yeah.
That's it. So thus concludes the Romar Dennis name usage in this paragraph. But yeah, so no, people were looking good. Bryce Wasserman started off strong, had like some good kind of dodging from X. Teddy Hatfield was playing attack. I think he had one early. Let's see who else. Yeah, Jasinski from his first name just ran away from me. Ohio State.
Jack.
There you go. I was going to call him Jake. Jack Jasinski had a solid game. It's kind of been in and out of the lineup. I don't think he's been that consistently in there, but you know, he's one of those people from up top who can draw a slide, gets a lot of attention. So that was the good Rattler stuff. And again, let's put a pin on that because they're tied at 8 at halftime. So that's a good thing, right? I mean, you know, you didn't lose the first half. We're tied at 8. I want to go back to talk about the Lizards for a second. Their first half was weird. It's tied, but it was weird because Rob Pinnell was being super ignored. Like ball rotations and everything, they were just not going to him. He was hardly part of the offense. It was a lot of sort of top-down initiation, a lot of, you know, midfield work. Ryan Walsh was back in the lineup. So he's, you know, starting up dodges from the wing. And Pinnell is really just kind of hanging out, you know, behind the goal, just chilling. Sometimes behind the goal, and then sometimes they just put him on the crease working, like, off-ball stuff. It was very un-Pinnell-like for 75% of the evening, I'll say. Also, Mark Matthews was out again. I'm not sure what's going on with him. I don't know if it's an injury, if it's prior commitments, but I'm going to try and figure out if somebody's got an answer for that. Well, first of all, yeah, do you happen to know?
I know that he got traded in his summer box league.
Oh. Okay.
But I don't know why. And I don't know if you followed any of that on Twitter. The Summer Canadian Box League Twitter is probably one of the most fun Twitters in lacrosse Twitter. Like, it's like a little subset that I occasionally enjoy, like, kind of dipping into a little bit. But yeah, I think he's probably, you know, I mean, he had a long NLL season. He might just be kind of really nicked up. I mean, I think when I talked to Coach O'Hara earlier, right before the season started, kind of preseason talk, he was kind of saying that Matthews is a little nicked up. So that might have kind of progressed into something more. And Maybe he's, you know, saving himself to do a little bit more in the box than he is for MLL, and or he's taking a break or whatever. But yeah, I don't think it's anything to do with his talents per se. I know he had that tough game against the Blaze where, you know, kind of got owned a little bit. Outlaws, where Dylan Ward kind of owned him a couple times and he was stunned. Which I don't think I've ever seen Mark Matthews stunned. Not a very emotional player. But, like, when you see the eyes through the mask, you're like, oh, he's actually surprised that didn't go in. He's one of those guys that, like, you know that he thinks the ball's going in every time he shoots.
Well, sure, yeah.
Which is most guys. But Matthews is close enough where, like, everyone else is also thinking that. So, like, I understand that part. But yeah, I think they're probably just like trying a bunch of new stuff. Cause like when you're 0-4, it's house money now. Throw whatever you can. I mean, I'm not surprised that they moved Pinnell around really. I think that maybe the thought was we have all these other guys that, and Rob touches the ball. Rob holds onto the ball for probably like 50% of every possession. So what happens if we take that away and just have Rob be like more of a player in the flow of the offense? And against Dallas, guess what? That's going to work. That's going to work. Clearly worked. But then, right. You know, I'm sure he still got the ball more as the game went on, right?
He absolutely did. And yeah, if you are going to try, you know, a major tweak to your offense, I feel like this is probably the game you should try it. It feels mean to the Rattlers, but, you know, it's the record. Anyway. Yeah.
The truth isn't mean. We've said that many times in this podcast. The truth is not mean.
Right. I appreciate that.
If you want mean, I have mean. Would you like mean?
Yeah, okay. Let's hear a little mean.
This Dallas Rattlers team is the worst MLL team since the Chicago Machine. Full stop.
That works.
I don't even think that's mean. It's not even mean. It's provable.
Right, yeah, I guess you could do some research, actual statistics, and back that up as a quantifiable fact.
I mean, that team lost 10 games. Is Dallas going to lose 10 games? Maybe.
if the pattern holds.
I believe they're halfway there.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, no, are they 0-6 or 0-5?
They're 0-5 right now.
Good God. So they're halfway there.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Record-breaking performances.
Possible. Possible. So let's wrap this one up. Lizards take the lead. The Rattlers kind of get a little shook on their own. For the second game in a row, they got shut out the entire fourth quarter. That's not great. Basically, it was kind of like the whole sort of Cinderella at midnight sort of thing. Everything that was great in the first half stopped working for them in the second. Like, they stopped doing the really sort of clever passes. The initiating and forcing the slides wasn't there. The angle on their shots was not great. You know what I mean? Like, you're driving down the alley and you just run too far before you shoot. There's a lot of that sort of stuff. It was basically mirror opposite of the first half. So that's how you end up losing 13-9. Question for you, wrapping this one up. Does this win mean anything?
No.
There you go. No further questions, Your Honor.
The defense rests. I don't think it does, really. I'm sure that New York wants to build on it, right? And they want to, you know, go back to what works. But I think they have to look back at who they played. I mean, listen, they've been in games. And it sounds like Dallas was in both these games in the first half, at least. And then just, like you said, you know, got turned into a pumpkin at some point.
Right.
I think that New York has a better chance to figure it out than Dallas. I'll say that. Still, at this point. And that has nothing to do with New York beating Dallas. I think the overall talent for New York is more salvageable than Dallas's talent. Because Dallas doesn't have an unbeatable star player. And New York has at least one, if not two, maybe three, depending on who you ask. You know? So I think that's just kind of how it happens. Like, you can't win in the MLL on a consistent basis without a star. You know, the star can play many different positions. But if your best player is your LSM, or your best player is, like, your goalie in the pros, you're done. You are done. You will win a couple games and that's it. And we've seen that happen for 10 years. I just think that's how it shakes out. So I don't think it really means much, but I'm sure the Lizards are going to want to build on it, and they should. They should want to do that to get better for their fans. Dallas, I mean, Dallas has to make more than just minor adjustments. They need to find a way to acquire a superstar if there's one available. And I don't know if there is.
Man, it would be interesting to see. That would be really interesting if they can pull something off here, trade time. But we'll see what kind of leveraging they have. But, yeah, let's see if they shake things up.
I mean, listen, maybe they, like, lure a guy out of retirement.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they got the star. They got the star, and they had some attendance numbers. You know, there could be something intriguing there.
And it's ironic. The only star they have is their stadium.
No mas. No mas.
Yeah, sorry. No, sorry. I'm still kicking. Stay down. You stay down.
Throw in the damn towel.
All right. I think that leads us into our PLL weekend recap, courtesy of yours truly. First game on a Friday. A little bit of a change here. A little bit of a change. Atlas 13, Archers 12. I want to talk about the game, but I also want to talk about the last play for the Archers, which was a calamity. The likes of which we have not seen since that Redwoods play where they were also awful, I think, in week three. And they had plenty of time to make a play, get something drawn up. They did not start the ball with Tom Schreiber. Mistake one. Right. Mistake two. The bailout player that ran all the way upfield to get the ball to free up the double was Marcus Holman. Marcus Holman didn't run after he got the ball. He kind of rocked back and forth and did like some stuttering with his feet. And then there was some other people like doing like looking around their defender to see what they should do. I've watched the play like multiple times. It just seemed like what they drew up in the huddle was so far removed from what happened on the field that everybody freaked out and went, oh my God, what do we do? And they biffed it. I mean, that's, you know, they biffed that lad. They had 24.5 seconds and they biffed it. And they still got a goal, shot on goal, which is insane, off of a rebound from off of Kincaid. And I just, it was exciting, but at the same time, it's like, okay, this is one of the things that I think maybe people that are kind of newer to the sport don't realize is like pro teams, you'd think that pro teams, pro lacrosse teams would be good at scoring out of a timeout. Let me be the first to tell you this. They are awful at scoring out of a timeout. You might as well not call the timeout a lot of the time. That goes against a lot of other people's philosophy. You got to trust me on this one. Just go. You got all these dudes on the field that are ex-coaches, current coaches, great players. They're going to do something better than what you draw up, maybe. But also, they're probably, once they get out there, going to draw up their own thing anyway. And that's the danger you take, taking the timeout in pro lacrosse. I've seen it happen more in pro lacrosse than any other level of lacrosse I've watched. It's a futile thing. I mean, still do it, I guess. But you have to try, like, the coach calling that timeout has to know that, like, some of these guys might not do this. And that's what happened. They just didn't do the play because they got thrown a weird defensive look where the poles ran up on the ball and there was no exits for the ball carrier out of the whistle, which is the first thing you need to draw up in your timeout. But I understand your pros, let them go, let them figure it out. They just didn't figure it out. Maybe it'll happen down the road for somebody, but I don't think we've seen anything out of a timeout in a key situation in a game in any league in 2019 where that's worked. So sorry, I need to start off on a negative there. I really think that Baptiste kind of won this game for the Atlas. An amazing day at the X. I think they had him with like a couple ground balls, which is like wildly inaccurate statistically wise, stat wise. I just, doesn't make any sense. He's a threat with the ball. And I think people are finally realizing that. And he's a guy that can command the X. And against, you know, Stephen Kelly, who, you know, has not been playing great insofar as his ability to win draws consistently. I think he's had great moments, obviously scoring the first goal in PLL history. He's gone on like 2-3 win runs, but he hasn't been the dominant guy that a team like the Archers not need, but would be better with. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a change there this week. But I think that it really cost them down the stretch. And, you know, it's not to take away from Baptiste. Baptiste is just really, really, really good. He's approaching, you know, his form at Denver, if not surpassing it, especially because he's kind of worked on the rest of his skills in indoor. And his ability to carry the ball is so much better. But the one thing I think, and I want to talk about this a little bit with you, and let me know what you think about this. A lot of people, like traditional lacrosse people, don't like the shortened field because they feel like the middies don't have enough room to dodge from up top. What are your, do you subscribe to that? What are your thoughts on that?
I feel like it, so I like it but it's not to say I want it everywhere. I enjoy watching both styles of lacrosse, you know? So I'm not saying like, oh yeah, cut all the fields up. But I feel like if you shorten the field, the players who can adapt to that
Right.
And players who can't, it's kind of an evolution. You know what I mean? Like the people who signed up to play in PLL, you know, you gotta adapt or die. And, you know, if that means maybe more sort of high wing dodges. So like Joel Tinney, especially in this game.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to initiate from the wings, you can do that. Or, you know, if you want to do sort of a 3-3 situation and have Tom Schreiber up top and, you know, just drop the other midfielders down a little bit, I think it's just kind of, you know, the onus is on everybody else to make the defenses adjust to what you're doing. It is a different sort of midfielders game. I don't think we're necessarily going to see so many just straight up alley split dodge kind of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But if you can find a way, like especially if you're going east-west, you can still do it. You just have to be good at it. And so, you know, it's not going to be for everybody. But, you know, what do I care if it's not for everybody?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one player that, you know, we're not talking about him yet or his game, but I think one player that's adapted that downhill Dodger style that works in PLL, maybe one of the only ones that's kind of made that work for him is John Rannigan.
Oh yeah.
You know, like he's figured it out, and I don't know if it's him not needing as much room to get started as some other guys, or if his team, I mean, he's playing with guys he's played with for like 5, 6, 7 years at this point, and I think that that's a huge advantage when you're that kind of player, because you need to have people know when you're going to do what you're going to do. And he does. And I think that a lot of these other teams don't have guys that have played together like, you know, the Chrome have, but they're still finding ways. And it's great that you mentioned Tinney. I think the high wing dodges are basically unstoppable if no one slides. I mean, he basically won the game for Atlas by himself, getting those mismatches on the high wing, getting that early sub and going right at that dude. And one of them, one time it was Kelly who got stranded and he just dusted him and went to the cage and scored. I think going to the other side of the ball, I think the Archers, they have to pair Schreiber with another Dodger. Like as it is, he's getting the pull and the quick slide and a back check almost every time he touches the ball. Still put up 2 and 3 here with all that defensive attention. But I think teams are figuring out if we do that and we get him high enough that he can't make passes to that great attack line, who is really good, you know, Will Manny, obviously, Marcus Holman, Kevin Rice, those guys are great at being, making the right movement at the right time, off ball, catching and finishing. But if you get into Schreiber's hands early and you force him to hit the exit instead of the crazy pass that you know he can hit, or you clog the middle so that pass is that much harder, that's the recipe for how you deal with him. And he's still going to get his points. Like, he's still going to get his. But at the same time, you have to make it hard for him. And I think the Atlas actually really did a good job of that. I thought Pafani was great in the passing lanes. It's the evolution of kind of the Atlas from that bully ball into a little bit more of a cerebral defense with the addition of KVN Raphorst is pretty apparent, and it's finally paying off with wins. But I also think offensively they're still a little stagnant. I think that the Archers went real quick on D and slid real quick and opened up a lot of lanes for McArdle and Law to just kind of step into. You know, and we saw that in kind of the third game of the weekend. I don't want to keep getting ahead of myself, but we saw that the Redwoods did a great job of that as well. So last week we kind of talked about how things are starting to shake out for the teams and that they're taking on different styles and strengths. After watching this game, what is the style and strength of the Archers, in your opinion?
So I think the Archers' style is, I feel like it really flourishes once they have the like ideal circumstances around it. You know, like I don't feel like they are the, I feel like they're kind of a polar opposite from the Chaos. If you, for example, the Archer's power play is gorgeous. And all it is, hey, Tom, go up top and figure it out.
Yeah.
But if you don't have an answer for that, then he's just going to keep picking people apart. So he'll just go 3-on-3 and they'll just start passing it to each other until he sees something open up. But like, that's the way that they really thrive. It's just kind of, we're going to break this down sort of analytical style. And, you know, you kind of have like, you know, you have Manny who can kind of take advantage of defenders who are maybe playing too far off or something like that. But a lot of it is very sort of precise. And so I see there are ways that it can go wrong if it does have to rely on this sort of precision and ideal situations to work out for it. But I think that is their style and their strength.
Yeah, as I was watching this game, I was kind of doing little tweets on the side, and I got a text from a pro player who was like, I don't know how else to say this, but I think that Tom Schreiber might be the best player I've ever seen.
Yeah, it is. It's remarkable. Not just that he's good. So, like, I mean, you know, you see him at Princeton and he was good, but seeing him get better over these years.
Yeah, man, here's the thing. Like, he wasn't that good at Princeton. He was good, but like, this is not like this.
Right. He was obviously a talented guy, like Twarton finalist, but it wasn't like, you know, Tom Schreiber's going to destroy the planet.
Right.
But you see him, I mean, just the freedom that they give him, because it's 100% earned, is just, there are very few players on that level where it's just like, all right, well, Tom will figure it out.
But there is another player on that team that's like that. And he doesn't get the ball ever. And it's Kevin Rice.
Yeah.
I what do you do with is Kevin Rice like trade bait? Just because it's clear that he doesn't fit into what they're doing, because Rice needs the ball to like do a lot of what he does best.
Yeah. It's interesting you ask that. I was actually mock trading Kevin Rice today when I was at work.
All right. As you do.
Right, sure, as one does. I couldn't find anything. Because, like, Kevin Rice, he is someone who absolutely thrives as the quarterback, you know?
Yeah.
And, nobody else doing it. You give him the ball, he'll make something happen. But this isn't the situation for him to do that. You know, like, it's interesting to me that they put Tucker Durkin on him during this game, because other teams have kind of, you know, flirted with doing a short stick on him for a while,
yeah,
or, you know, another defender, but they put Durkin on him. And like, so at my work, I'm trying to do this mock and I'm like, all right, where can we put Kevin Rice? So obviously you take away the Archers because he's on it. So then you start looking around. Chaos? Are you going to put him on attack there?
No.
No, and you're not going to get rid of any of those guys for him. So, say Chrome? I mean, they're not putting him with Jordan Wolfe again, like we saw that in Rochester.
Nope.
No, it's one of them or the other one, or else you're going to move, like, Rice out the box, and that's not going to work. Or else Wolfe out the box. That didn't work either. Whip Snakes? Are you going to give him the ball and, like, tell Rambo to stop?
MVP candidate Matt Rambo? No.
Right. Redwoods? I mean, they just got Henningberg. Are they going to shake that up now for, you know what I mean? They're going to put, like, who are they going to move? Kavanaugh?
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, there's just nowhere for him to go. Atlas? I mean,
he could go to the Atlas.
So you move, okay, see, there we go. If you put him on the Atlas, and let's say, I mean, they've got some attackmen that they're kind of moving around there. Does Law? Who says no to that one? Eric Law to the Archers?
No, because you already have, like, younger Eric Law with Will Manning.
Will Manning, yeah. So, I mean, I don't think...
Also, you can't trade a ghost. I checked.
Also true.
Can't trade a ghost.
Also true. Yes, I mean, like, I feel like the Atlas would be, if anyone, but I don't know what you would put on paper to get it done. They didn't really seem to use Kluche that much this week. They kind of got away from their plan from 2 weeks ago, where it was just, you know, like constantly him in the midfield or McArdle. And I mean, they're not getting rid of McArdle, right? So.
Are they?
I don't know.
I think it's interesting. I think you're right that the trade doesn't, it's not clean. There's not a one for one that works.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a way it works, and there's a way that Rice kind of fixes a lot of the Atlas's problems, but also kind of creates new questions. And I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say a lot of egos. I think there's a lot of strong personalities on that Atlas team. And I think that's not a great fit for Rice, who also has his own, you know, has his own thoughts. Not a dude that, like, he's not like a bad guy. I'm not saying that at all. And he's not like super critical or anything like that, or super outspoken. But like, he has a way that he thinks the game should be played. And if you don't play that way, he will let you know. And that's what kind of being in the pros is all about, is navigating that, right? Is figuring that out and figuring out your spot. I just think that it's so obvious that Rice doesn't fit there in the Archers. And I don't know if he's too good to drop. Like, they can't drop him.
No.
Right? Then you haven't, you, but you've, like, I've gotten like Twitter messages like, what's up with Rice? And I'm like, Rice doesn't fit with Schreiber. I just think that's pretty apparent to me. I mean, the team you'd like throw him on, which you can't do, which we already talked to, is probably the Chrome, who are probably like, what do we do?
Sure.
You know, we're winless. We need to fix this. But yeah, I don't really have a great answer. But, you know, congratulations to the Atlas on their win, kind of moving up the standings a little steadily there. Archers, I don't think it's time to like freak out, but I think they definitely need a win this week to kind of bounce back and kind of show people like what's up. Because I think their defense, especially their short sticks, did not play as well as they had in the previous 4 weeks as well. Let's move on to the second PLL game. Oh boy, of course it's an OT game. Chaos 15, Chrome 14 in OT. The poor, 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 homeless, winless Chrome. Unable to catch a break, but also shooting themselves in the foot with an offsides penalty in overtime. If you get a penalty in OT, you deserve to lose, full stop. Is that wrong?
No, you are quite right. If it is a questionable push or something like that, then you can say, you know, oh, these refs stuck it to us. But if you do not employ the proper amount of lacrosse players on the proper sides of the field, that is something that should be punished with an L.
Yeah, and it was. The Chrome looked pretty good here, as they have in a bunch of their games that they have lost. Interesting to see that Ned Crotty got all the runs in the second half to get the team back in it, when in the first quarter, and you know, they were abysmal, but then McIntosh went into the second quarter and just carried the load like he was Samwise Gamgee. Just like put him on his back. And yes, that's me saying Ned Crotty is Frodo. Just to be clear. Just to be clear. I think that that's the kind of thing they need to win. I think what people do with Wolf is what everyone does with Wolf now, where they zone the corner. You know, they just keep a guy there, so he can't break GLE. And then the few times where maybe the spacing works out that they can't do that, he's able to get at least a shot on goal against anyone on earth. So you do have to account for Wolf, but you also know not how to neutralize him, but to limit him a little bit. And I think that the Chaos did that better early than later. And the Chaos played their namesake. You know, there's a bit of nominative determinism here with the Chaos. They play to their namesake. Again, the bomb squad, Gerard Newman, two bomb, turned out to be one of the biggest two-pointers of the year. Also great on ball. What do you think about him emerging in the PLL? Because in the MLL, he didn't get a ton of burn with the launch. Like, he didn't get a lot of ink coming out of Providence. Kind of everyone knew he was a good player. I actually had coaches in the MLL be like, stop talking about him because you're raising his draft stock. And yeah, other people are going to get on, are going to pick him. Like, stop writing about him, which of course I didn't. But I do believe in his talent. I watched him play at Providence, and he was one of the best defensemen in college lacrosse that year. What do you make of his kind of emergence here in the PLL as more of an offensive threat in the middle of the field?
Well, so I think he has really been a revelation, and talented, of course, but there's a combination that he's provided now of sort of talent and, I guess, PR, for lack of a better sort of, you know, I mean, he's got a spotlight right now. And, you know, the team is a very good fit for him. They definitely have no problem letting their guys come down and fire off these shots. And so he's one of these players who have found a little bit of a tweak in this game that is something he can hold on to, something that he can kind of take advantage of, you know? And so he's getting good defensive matchups. Like, he's not a liability they're hiding. He is a talented defender, very rangy guy, because, I mean, he's like 6'4 or something like that. Covers a lot of ground, you know, he can knock down passes and start up, you know, with ground ball transition game. But also having this shot, it's just making him and players like him just this sort of, you know, we don't really see players like that in the past. And so he's one of these people who, yeah, this is his evolution is going in a very, very positive direction, thanks to the kind of tweaks in this league and the fortune of being on the team he's on.
Yeah, I think that defense has actually benefited from Sertic, and kind of Rowlett being Rowlett has cost them a little bit. But at the same time, like, it seems like they don't care.
Yeah, they're never going to stop him.
They're just like, let's wind him up and let him go. And, like, he's going to get two or three penalties a game, and, you know, we just got to get our man down. But I feel like if you call Andy Towers right now and we're like, what are you going to do with the Rowlett thing with him getting penalties all the time and, you know, mashing people? He'll probably be like, oh, I love it. I love him.
Yes.
He's like my son, you know, like, I feel like that's the kind of response you would get from Towers. And it feels like out of all the coaches in the league, in terms of how to talk to players and relate to players and this like generation of players, he's the best at it. He gets it because he's like pushing dudes and like making dudes laugh on the other side of the ball. And I don't want to get into the pre-pod debate about why lacrosse isn't funny and no one in lacrosse is funny. We're going to save it for later. But before we started even recording this, Chris and I had a long conversation about why it's weird that no one in lacrosse is funny. I think Towers is probably funny. You know, like you can see him messing with players on the other team. Like when they got that offsides penalty, he's like pushing Matt Donowski and like laughing. And I'm like, what is happening? Like, what is this? This is, it's a different level of relating to the players, you know? It's impressive. And it's, you know, they're getting wins from it. I think the comeback here to tie it is really worrisome if you're looking at it big picture, though. Because as much as they, I don't want to say don't value the ball, but they value possessions more than they value the ball. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because they just want to stack the possessions and like they just trust all those dudes to do something crazy to score a goal is what it seems like to me. And they also do a great job of like going flat on breaks, and that opens up opportunities for guys carrying and trailing the play to kind of cash in on those not even fast breaks, but uneven situations. I think the Chaos are better than anyone else at that. Maybe the Redwoods are there. They're getting there. They definitely look like it in the against the Whipsnakes this week. But yeah, I just think that it's, you know, the way that the Chaos play versus how the Chrome play is so different, and we're still getting to 14, 15 goals here, and 15 goals being the decider. And I felt like even before the penalty, it was the Chaos's game to lose going into OT, even though they had no momentum. I think I put that down to that team culture being, you know, brash, but also like backing it up. And I think that's how, you know, one of the issues I think we've seen PLL kind of deal with is how do we get people to root for different teams? Right. I mean, like, yeah, we could write, you know, I'm putting this down in the rejected story ideas at the bottom of the podcast rundown, but we could do like, who is the average fan of the Chaos? Like, typecast that out for me. Do it. Who loves the Chaos?
So I feel like people who love the Chaos are not like Jazz listeners. I feel like
what a distinction.
They don't listen to Jazz. I implore you to find an overlap between Jazz, smooth Jazz, and the Chaos. See, because I was going to say something like, I was trying to think of like a hard rock band or whatever, but I could only think of like rock rap bands. And I was like, no, that's going to sound like an insult because people act like they didn't get down to rap rock.
Oh, yeah, you didn't like Linkin Park? Shut up.
Right.
Shut up.
I was going to be, yes, exactly. I was going to be like, yo, a lot of Linkin Park. And then someone's going to be like, that's messed up. And I'm going to be like, Linkin Park sold 50 million albums. Act like you know.
Yeah.
You know? So, but you get it. You get where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
They like the intensity. Pre-workout. A lot of pre-workout.
a lot of pre-workout connoisseurs, Chaos fans.
Right, right. Okay. Whether or not you're going to the gym.
I'm with you so far. Give me one more defining characteristic.
Let's see here.
I'm going to go with rides a motorcycle or has ridden a motorcycle in the last year.
Yes. Let me spread that out a little bit more, and I will say, if not a motorcycle, something that doesn't have four wheels.
Or something that goes really, really fast.
Right. So like a shopping cart down a hill.
Yeah.
Would qualify.
Or like your uncle's like GT that isn't finished, but you took it out anyway. Those are Chaos fans.
Right. Or one of those scooters, but you didn't pay for the scooter.
Right. You use your friend's code. Yeah. No, I'm with you. Guys that wear hats backwards. Chaos fans. I feel like people think we're making fun of it. I'm actually not.
No.
I'm really not.
Exactly. That's the thing. That's the Linkin Park conundrum.
It's making fun of it, and then there's having fun with it. We're just having fun with it. We're not making fun of it. But yeah, Chaos kind of their top of the standings now after the Whipsnakes loss, which we're going to get into right now. I do think that some of these like viral video things haven't really hit with me, but Justin Gutterding chirping Miles Jones for having a low goal count was amazing. I was dying. I feel like very few people have been picking on the star players for the numbers, and it's super interesting to see another player do it before like one of us did it.
Yeah, I saw that video and I was like, man, how did he know that? Like he's really been paying attention to his stats. Like, he just had that in his back pocket. He knew exactly how many goals he had.
Dude, Gutterding's like one of those dudes that like downloads games and has like, you know, a USB, has every game on a USB drive and just like puts it in a computer before he like goes to sleep and plays it while he sleeps. Just absorbs it. Osmosis.
My favorite part about that was that Miles had no comeback. Like, it was checkmate. It's like, what do you say, you know, to the, you know, Miles was like, hey, you know, they're going to switch up your matchups. And he's like, you scored three times this season. And he's just like, huh.
Stunned.
Good day to you.
I was stunned. It was great. That was a great kind of moment, manufactured or not. Let's get on to the third game. Redwoods, 14. Whipsnakes, 11. Whipsnakes taking the first L. I feel like it almost seemed like there was too much settled offense for the Whips here. You know, they went up, but the Redwoods hit three pipes in the first quarter alone. Like, not just like, ooh, it grazed the pipe, we reset the shot clock. Like, bam, that ball went to half field. Bam, that ball rolled, like, fired itself out of bounds on the wing. They just had Threadwood Woods had no problem getting looks, and they just kept attracting Whipsnake defenders up top with little mid dodges and picks, and then just finishing down low and getting like really good mid-range looks on almost anyone. But in particular, they were picking on the shorties a lot. And I think that there wasn't a ton of support for those guys. But also, I think that the Whipsnakes poles are not used to giving support to those guys like Warner and Bernhardt, because I think they expect them to kind of hold the Dodger a little better, and they just didn't. I think the Redwoods Dodgers really executed here. But I do want to talk about kind of the other side of the ball. Every conversation with the Redwoods goes back to their defense somehow, and that's not really what I want to keep doing. But it's so good that you can't not talk about it. One guy we haven't talked about enough, I don't think, monster game from Timmy Trautner here. I want to say that I can't remember a more impactful rookie goalie in pro lacrosse since Trautner. I'd have to go back to Kip Turner. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, what we're so used to seeing is, you know, a couple goalies will get drafted and basically just sit.
Yep.
You know, because first of all, the leagues are so small, and, you know, goalie's going to stick around for a while, and they want him to see, you know, kind of get used to the game speed from everybody. You know, everybody on the field's going to shoot at 90 miles an hour. And you're not going to have, you know, days and days and weeks to practice with your team. So, I mean, it is like it's a pit, you know, throwing a goalie back there and just saying, all right, figure it out. And you've got a guy, Tim Trautner, you know, coming from High Point, so it's not like, you know, it's not like he's the Notre Dame goalie telling all of his old teammates what to do.
Right.
You know, this, he's just thrown in this situation, and he has just thrived like every single step of the way. The thing that kind of stood out to me during this game, they showed a clip of the Whipsnakes huddle, and you see Jim Stagnita actually says, he was like, look, if he sees it, he's going to say it. And I mean, you've got a coach with an undefeated team making this giant concern, how are we going to, you know, deceive this rookie goalie, because we're going to have to find a way around this to score. It's not just going to be a shot, because he's going to stop it. I mean, I can't think of anything that's more like more respect coming from somebody than that. But that's the kind of respect Trautner has already earned this early in his pro career.
Yeah, I'm super impressed. I don't think it's normal for this to happen. I can't overstate how difficult it is to go from college at any level of college to playing goalie in the pros, especially now with a 52-second shot clock. Although Trautner has a lot of history with how his team played. I believe High Point is at least top three in turnovers last year. So he saw a lot of ball. He saw a lot of rubber last year. And I think that probably prepared him. You know, in other sports, you hear about pro offenses, pro defenses. The best pro thing that readies you for pro as a goalie is probably playing on a team where you see a ton of shots. And Trautner did. You know, as good as High Point were, they were a little careless with the ball, and he had to make a lot of spectacular shots, saves one-on-one with uncontested shots. And with this Notre Dame-based defense playing in front of him, now he has guys that alter shots, you know, that get stick into hip and push guys out of their angle and make them uncomfortable and take velocity off the ball. And I think that's part of the reason he's done so well, but I don't think it's the only reason. And I think he's done a lot of the work to make that defense his and also kind of trust them. And that was very evident here. I felt like this loss was building for the Whipsnakes. You know, as we know, they were undefeated coming in here, but the games were too close for comfort. And they really needed something they couldn't do here, which was an execution of one of their crazy 4-8 goal runs. And they couldn't do that on a stout Redwoods defense when they needed it. Like, I know the poles are so good for Redwoods, But I also thought the D-mids were so great for the Redwoods here. And as a result of that, I think that Pat Harbison might be the most underrated. I'm not even going to say short stick D-mid or D-mid. I'm going to say utility man in lacrosse. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and so I definitely agree with the shifting towards utility man, especially in this sort of PLL era. There is going to be a room for a purely defensive midfielder, but the people who are really going to shine are the people who, like Harbison, who can make the plays and shut down like a like a midfielder who's trying to dodge by them and keep the play going onto the other side of the field. And he's one of the people who has that ability and has really been doing it consistently these past few games. Like, there have been some guys who have had good games, and like I've noted, you know, I've written it down and been like, you know, oh, hey, this guy, you know, had a great transition game, you know, really solid D midfield, but then the next game he'll get toasted a bunch of times, and then I'll just delete that from my notes and be like, oh, we don't need to talk about that guy, you know. Harbison's been consistent. He's been antagonizing to his opponents. He's been strong on defense and strong leading the offensive charge as well.
Yeah, I relate to Harbison a lot, not because I played D-mid ever, but I think that the way you play when you're not as big as everyone else is you either play with the flow or you antagonize the other team to the point where they hate you. And it takes the focus off of what they're doing against everyone else because they hate you so much. And I think P. Harb does that. And that's part of the game. That's part of it. You know, I'm not saying he's like, he plays dirty, but he's in the mix on every ball. That ball hits the ground, he's somewhere running towards it or throwing a check so someone can't get it. And if that neither one of those two things fails, he's in there getting it himself. So I think that's kind of a big part of that. But in the pros, I mean, I can't remember. I think I was listening to an interview with Kyle Harrison where he was saying that like the guy that agitates people is Harbison. Like he's kind of like the talisman for that team. He's the guy that kind of pushes that forward. I mean, I think everyone kind of expects it to be like Matt Landis or Garrett Eppel or Eddie Glazner, but I think it's probably P. Harb or because Brent Adams just silently kills you. Brent Adams is a ninja. You know, like he's just going to kill you with his speed and like smile at your face. But P. Harb is going to let you know about it. So sorry if I like am not allowed to call him P. Harb, but I DM'd him on Twitter today. I feel like we're closer. And I made a joke. We're taping this on Monday. I made a joke that I convinced the IL staff to make this D-Midi week. And I think people thought it was a joke. I'm here to tell you it's not. We're doing D-Mid pieces. It might not all come out in the week. We might stagger them a little bit, but we're giving love to D-Mids. So I would like D-Mids to stay out of my mentions with negative feedback for at least a year. Like, you're welcome. Honestly. Let's not... I'm helping you now. One other thing I wanted to get your thoughts on. How do you think these two coaches in particular with the Redwoods and the Whipsnakes, Nat St. Laurent and Jim Stagnino respectively, how do you think they're dealing with the eternal struggle of fast versus controlled offenses? How are all the coaches doing? Like, who's doing the best job?
I mean, so, you know, we definitely talked about them a little bit earlier. I think Towers really just kind of just bathes in the fast versus controlled offense sort of thing. I think that's just what he bleeds, you know, so I think he's loving it. I think both Stagnita and Nat St. Laurent have done a good job with it. I think it largely comes down to something you were discussing earlier is just your vibe with the players around you. And I think both of these coaches have really good dynamics with their players. You know, this is just based on watching the games, watching the huddles, and things like that. But it seems like both of these guys, I would say St. Laurent seems to be more of like, if you're gonna position them in like a literal relative sort of way, Stagnita seems kind of like cool dad-ish, whereas Saint Laurent seems like cool uncle.
Okay.
You know, he's kind of like I don't see Stagnita, you know, jumping up, doing like a side high five or something like that, or, you know, putting somebody in a headlock and being like, you know, oh, I love you, no. MFers, or something like that, right?
If Jim Stagnita is not watching the game with his arms crossed, is he even there?
Right.
He's not even there.
Right. He's like, you know, all right, boys, hey, you know, let's be smart. I'm proud of the decisions you're making. Let's just be smart. But, you know, Nat doesn't seem to approach things with that same sort of restraint. And, you know, neither one seems to foster, like, resentment, though. You can have a dad coach or you can have an uncle coach, and they're both cool. Unless, you know, I think if you have a cool dad coach and you have a problem with it, that's more on you than the coach. But, yeah, I think they're both doing pretty well in that regard. Do you think there are some coaches who are thriving less than those?
I worry about John Paul because I think he's gotten some bad edits on TV where he's like handed a clipboard to someone for a play. It's not a great edit. That's it could be something that they've worked on and then someone else is going to kind of draw that up. But I think that hasn't been kind to him, but I don't know. I think now the team's kind of coming around, so it's hard to like criticize him. I think that the Chrome are having trouble relating to Dom, and I don't think it's just because they're 0-5. I think they're just having trouble relating to him, connecting to him. I think that group of guys, again, not to keep harping on this point, but that's a group of guys that like legitimately loved their coach with Tim Sudan. Like, he's like he's not even their cool dad. He's like their cool stepdad who like let them hang out in the garage and like break stuff. Like, that's who Tim Sudan is. And I think that it's a culture shock for them to go from that to, and Coach Warder was similar. You know, he was on that coaching staff in Rochester and in Dallas. So I think that's a big part of it. But I think insofar as guys like, just to get back to Stags and St. Laurent, I think St. Laurent's ability to adjust on the fly in pro lacrosse is very impressive. Because they made, like, Grenlian was hurt, and guys, he's going to be out for a couple weeks at least, if not more, with a hamstring injury. So expect to see him move there for the Redwoods, for a faceoff guy. And what they did was, they basically had Grenlian not just concede it, but he would stay on the attack side. And once Nardella won, and they would send Tyler Dunn from the attack to chase down the ball, which is like an adjustment. I can't remember the last time I saw that adjustment. Like, that's not that it's like the greatest thing in the world, but it's like in the moment. That's something that I was like, wow, okay. That's not something you'd think that the first thing you would do when your faceoff guy is struggling is you double pull, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And they could totally do that, and I think they did do it for a couple draws, but that's actually almost better because now you're kind of eliminate as long as you stop the ball and stop a two pass fast break, you're eliminating that faceoff guy from the equation with a back check. And a experienced D-mid chasing him down. Or not experienced, but because Tyler Dunn's a rookie, but a capable guy chasing him down. So, you know, I've seen him do a couple other things where, you know, a play doesn't work, and then the next time they have a different play. If you look at the Chrome, a play doesn't work, and then they do it again. Or a play works once, and then they do it four times in a row. And it doesn't work the other four times. So I think that one of the things you look at with coaching these pros, and a lot of them are younger, and certain teams are younger, and certain teams are older, and certain teams have more ego than other ones. But I think that overall, I think St. Laurent and Towers have done the best job so far. I'm the most impressed with them. I thought Bates did a really good job early, but again, I think that's a personnel thing. And like we were talking about, I think just Rice doesn't fit into what they're doing. And they're making kind of weird moves roster-wise that I don't really understand. But I think that that can sort itself out. It's not like any of these are unsalvageable situations. Except for maybe the Crum. So maybe. I mean, maybe they figure it out. I think it's going to take more than one win to right that ship, though. What do you think?
Yeah, so a thing I always like to pay attention to as far as the coaching and player chemistry goes, I always like to see when the players are in a huddle, when they break from the huddle, if they get it right the first time. You know, if it's like, all right, guys, roll Woods on three. You know, they say 1, 2, 3, roll Woods or whatever.
Yeah.
Nothing sits worse to me than when a huddle doesn't break clean. And they're like, you know, okay, guys, together on three or whatever. And it's like, yeah, together. And then half the guys walk away and they're like, come on, bring it back. Let's go. Come on. What are we doing, guys?
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Nothing sits worse. And I've seen that. I've seen that with the Chrome where they're like, oh, come on, let's do this again. Let's go. It's just like, you know, maybe it's something, maybe it's nothing. But for whatever reason, when I see huddles that don't break smoothly, I'm always like, oh, man, what's happening here? What's going on with these guys? So that sticks out to me a little bit. I do want to ask you a little bit about the Chrome. This one thing, though, goalie switch.
Yeah.
What did you think about that? And what do you think about it going forward?
It was great. He made the right call. That's a great call. That was a great coaching decision. Because Queener brought them an energy that they previously did not have. I think Queener had trouble tracking Josh Burns' shot, or anytime someone dropped the stick low and went high, he had trouble with the ball. But everything else he saved, and he actually made a great save because he held his pipe on the right side that I think could have like really blown it open. And the fact that he made that save with like, you know, fundamental goalie play kind of made me think that he probably should be the starter. I think that, you know, he's played as a starter and he's played as a change of pace, change of style goalkeeper before. I wouldn't be surprised if he started next week. I think he played that well. But I also think, like, part of that is teams not adjusting to him. And I think the issue with Queener is that if you can adjust to him and his style and catch him out and ride him hard, he can kind of get, you know, I didn't see it, but he's the original snap my shaft over my knee because I let in a bad goal goalie. Is that fair?
No, yeah, that's right. I've forgotten about that, but yeah. A lot of the, you know, absolutely lose your mind on your defense. Yeah, that's originally coming from him, yeah.
I mean, you saw him lose it on a ref because he thought it was too quick of a restart. So,
right.
I mean, let's look at that. But also, I think he earned it. I think he had a great game. I think he had stats that looked like he played the whole game. And he didn't. So I think you give him a shot. I mean, again, it's, are we throwing stuff at the wall to see if it sticks? Or are we sticking with the game plan and thinking that we're good enough? We just weren't lucky enough to win. I think we've turned the corner where you have to do the former instead of the latter. Right? It's time to start changing some stuff.
Agreed.
All right.
I'm intrigued to see what Dom actually goes with this week. That's one of the things I'm looking forward to the most. But we'll see.
Yeah. All right. And that is week 5 in professional lacrosse. We had a big question, but we ran real long. So we're going to roll over right to the end of the podcast and go with our recommendation of the week. So this is going to be weird. I'm just letting you know.
Of course.
You're like, yeah, you're talking. It's weird. I have been marathoning Star Trek Deep Space Nine because I found an article on Medium that was like this lovingly written, sprawling epic about how great the show is. And it had a watcher's guide with like best essential episodes for each season. And it just hooked me. And this show is pretty awesome. It was made in, basically is the 90s, but because it's a sci-fi show, it's kind of just on the, it's just flavoring it with 90s. It's not everywhere. It's just little kind of molecules of 90s kind of infused into it. I'll admit that even the best, like Star Trek, is hokey and kind of lame. But DS9 is dark and has a ton of World War II themes coupled with like this complex morality. And honestly, it feels weirdly modern given several situations that are parallel with present time, like, for example, current immigration issues in the United States and the world. Again, Star Trek is boring at times, but DS9 is legitimately fun. I'm on season three, but I've noticed that as the season goes on, the writers just kept going, what if we did this? And someone clearly told them no, and then they just did it in a different way. Which I obviously love, because that parallels...
That sounds familiar.
It's basically my life at Inside the Cross. So I love that aspect of it, just throwing haymakers. It's not for everyone. I'm not going to recommend it for everyone, but if you like sci-fi that's oddly modern, this might be the show for you. It's all on Netflix, all 7 seasons. Chris, related to this, I have 2 questions for you. One, sure. Have you ever watched any Star Trek? If so, which Star Trek character are you most like?
I've never seen an episode of Deep Space Nine. I think I saw a couple of the Next Generations.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about them, but I think I've probably watched one or two of those. I don't think I've seen an original one all the way through either.
No movies?
I saw Generations.
Oh God.
You know?
Okay.
That was the first Shatner Star Trek movie I saw. I saw Generations. I didn't see any of the other Star Trek movies except for the new Abrams reboot stuff. I've seen, I think, 2 of those.
All right.
So I'm not the guy regarding Star Trek Deep Space Nine info, but I can tell you this. As far as a character I am like from Star Trek, somebody once told me I looked like Jake from Deep Space Nine, and everybody else told me that that was very wrong, and that was not at all someone I actually resembled.
Yeah, you actually look more like the Vulcan dude from Voyager. I don't know his name. I'm not as nerd. This is coming across as I'm like a super nerd right now, but I just like this one show I never watched and felt like I should have. But that's who I would pick, but you're not like that character. You just kind of look like him. But also I will say that Jake in Deep Space Nine is the son of the commander of the station. And as we all know, kids in TV shows are terrible. Jake is one of the exceptions. So it's not an insult if someone said you're kind of like that character.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. So the kid was like, hey, mom, doesn't this guy look just like Jake? And
wow.
Like, I was like, I don't know Jake, but I'm certain you're just wrong. And my dad was like, I don't know this either. And the mom was like, he looks smart like Jake.
Fair.
To kind of say, yeah, you know, you don't want to be like, no, son, you're an idiot. This guy doesn't look like Jake. But, you know, you also want to smooth everything along. So she was like, I look smart like Jake. So all I know about that show is that there's a guy on it named Jake who I probably don't resemble, but is smart and in a way in which I also carry myself like.
I will say, if you're listening to this and you have an idea for what Star Trek character Rosie might most not resemble, but be like, hit us up on Twitter. Let us know. I feel like mine's pretty obvious, and I'm not even going to put it out there. But roll that out if you want to. What's your recommendation of the week?
Okay, so I'm going to do a mini recommendation that I just discovered. I obtained some helpful information to some, totally not helpful to most, but I now know it, so it is part of my duty as someone on a podcast to share it with the world. From July 3rd to 7th, Cheesecake Factory orders over 1776 get a free Oreo Dream Extreme. I don't know what that is exactly, but I think it is some kind of chocolate cheesecake thing with Oreos literally placed inside of it and like an Oreo on top. So do with that what you will. If you are nearby a Cheesecake Factory or consider yourself a Cheesecake Factory connoisseur, go get yourself a free Oreo Dream Extreme. Now, my actual recommendation is an Instagram account that a friend of mine recommended to me a couple days ago. He sent me this message and was like, "Hey, have you heard of Milo the Cat?" And I said no, and I guess foolishly assumed it was an Instagram about a cat. It is not. Milo the Cat is not an actual cat. To my knowledge, I think it's somebody named Milo, but in hindsight, it might be a guy who named the account after his cat. I don't know. Maybe it's a cat. Doesn't matter. Basically, what this account is this guy just makes music videos, and he makes them using, like, old cartoons and stuff like that, but then he syncs the footage from the cartoons up with rap songs.
Oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think people have done this before. I don't necessarily think he's the first person to do that, but, like, he will take, one of them that killed me was he took footage from Doug and synced it with The Far Side's Passing Me By.
Wow.
So like it looks like, you know, Doug's rapping in some of it, and like, you know, he's acting out some of the scenes from the song. And basically it's just like stuff like that. They had some Muppets playing the saxophone, you know, that perfectly syncs with this, you know, Pete Rock and Seal Smooth song. It's just, so anyways, if you like, you know, 30 second clips of old rap songs, and I don't know why somebody would hate that. That's a weird thing to hate. But if you can at least stand that, I would suggest checking out Milo the Cat. At the very least, you get to listen to some old rap tracks, and you get to see some clever or funny editing with cartoon characters too.
I have two reactions to those recommendations.
Sure.
The first one is, when you said saxophone, I immediately went to Rump Shaker and got scared. And number two, listeners, find yourself a partner in life that looks at you and talks about you the way Chris Rosenthal talks about Oreos, and you'll be a happy person. I'm going to tell you that right now. That's our show. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week to recap all of the wonderful pro lacrosse goodness of week 6 in the PLL and the MLL. Chris, where can people find you?
At ChrisRosie22.
And you can find me, as always, at @TheKyleDevitt on Twitter. Thanks for listening. We are out.